about how Claire was always closer to her father, but then, after the divorce, was close to no one. About the guilt and second-guessing Fiona lived with every day. But it would only distract from the main point. She said, "Some people are just born difficult." That's a hard thing to say. She didn't feel great. She was thirsty, but the water they'd given her was sparkling, which she hated. She took a tiny sip, and it was worse than the thirst. "Does the boyfriend heat?" This was from Serge. And although it was a legitimate question, Fiona resented the intrusion into Arnaud's line of reasoning. "I don't think so. Some of the stories we found online about the Hosanna, it sounded like they hit their children for discipline, and I'm sure it went beyond that. But I've known Kurt a long time, since he was a kid. He's good with animals, you know? I don't think you can hit women and be good with animals. Animals would sense it." Arnaud nodded slowly. "Let's assume she left the cult when she discovered she was pregnant." Fiona was impressed. She and Damien had come to a similar conclusion, but only days after she'd found the video, after they'd stayed up past midnight drinking wine in two different cities, planning and theorizing over the phone. The best they'd gotten along in 15 years. But who cared about that now? Occasionally she'd hear Damien's wife in the background, and then he'd say, "Karen thinks we should do X." But it was never anything helpful. Karen had just been diagnosed with breast cancer, a treatable kind, and was starting radiation next week, which, along with his class schedule, was the reason Damien wasn't here too. Arnaud said, "And the boyfriend's family? Have they heard from him?" She said, "I only know his mother. She doesn't want anything to do with him." Her chest was tight, and her head was filling with gray noise. She felt Serge's hand on her arm, and realized she was closer to her omelet than she should have been. She had fallen forward. "She flew just this morning," Serge was saying. Arnaud said, "She hasn't eaten her food." "I'll take her home." "I can hear you," she said. "I'm right here. I bring my motorbike around." "No," she said, "we're not done." Arnaud folded his napkin into a neat triangle, tucked it under the rim of his plate. "But we are. Now what I do is look." 1985. No one wanted to do much in the weeks after Nico's memorial. Whoever you called was busy taking food to Terrence's place. Or you yourself were taking food to Terrence. Or people were sick, just regular sick, with coughs brought on by the drop in temperature. Guys with families flew home for Thanksgiving to play straight for nieces and nephews, to assure their grandparents they were dating, no one special, a few nice girls. To assure their fathers, who had cornered them in various garages and hallways, that no, they weren't going to catch this new disease. Charlie and his mother, being British, had no investment in the holiday, despite Yale's protests that it was a day for immigrants. British immigrants in particular. Yale wound up cooking Cornish game hens for himself and Charlie, plus Asher Glass and Terence and Fiona. Teddy and Julian would drop by for dessert. Asher arrived first, and after he handed over the loaf of bread he'd baked, still warm, wrapped in a towel, he shoved a manila envelope at Yale. "Don't let me force this on them till the end of the night," he said. "Keep it from me. Not till there's coffee in my hand, okay?" Yale didn't understand, but he stuck the envelope on top of the refrigerator, found a serrated knife for the bread. Asher had a New York accent, and the way he pronounced certain words, coffee, for instance, made Yale want to mouth them in his wake. Charlie poured a gin and tonic for Asher without asking. "You really pulled the plug," he said. "No going back?" The Howard Brown Clinic, where they both were on the board, had finally, after much debate, decided that next month it would start offering the HTLV-3 test, the one doctors had been giving since the spring. Asher had quit, vocally. According to Charlie, He'd stabbed a ballpoint pen into the table as he made a point, and the thing had burst, so that when Asher finally stormed out of the board meeting, it was with blue hands. Yale had harbored a crush, an occasionally overwhelming one, on Asher for years. It was quite specific. It would flare up mostly when Asher was angry about something, when his voice grew stentorian. The most ridiculous of Yale's first loves was Clarence Darrow, as portrayed in Inherit the Wind, which he'd read in 10th grade. He'd avoided speaking in class for 2 whole weeks, terrified his cheeks would redden if he tried to discuss the play. Funny, because when Charlie got similarly agitated, Yale wanted to stuff his own ears with cotton, and his attraction would flare up when Asher's dark hair got shaggy, which it was right now, making him look like a young, unkempt Marlon Brando. Stockier and clumsier, but still. Asher ran his law practice out of his own apartment on Aldine, and what had started out as housing equality work had quickly turned into wills and insurance battles. He was a daytime friend, not someone to hit the bars with at night. His love life, in fact, was a mystery, and Yale could never figure out if Asher would approach sex with the same intensity with which he approached his work, or if, having spent all his passion on the day's battles, he'd rather just call an escort once a week. He'd been talking a lot lately about the difference between activism and advocacy, and Yale couldn't remember which Asher was in favor of, or if he wanted everyone to do both. He had shoulders like barrels, and his eyelashes were long and dark. And Yale required a valiant effort not to stare at his lips when he talked. Asher's voice had already started to boom, loud enough that Yale worried Terrence might hear if someone had let him in downstairs and he was already out in the hallway. "Look, we all have a death sentence, right? You and me, we don't know what that is. It's a day, it's 50 years. You want to narrow the range? You want to freak yourself out? That's all the test gives you. I mean, show me the line for the miracle cure and I'll take the damn test. And I'll make everyone else take it too. Meanwhile, what? You want to end up in a government database?" Charlie said, "You know where I stand." "I do. And listen." Asher's hands were flying, gin spilling down the side of his glass. Yale leaned back against the sink, watched those hands like a fireworks show. "If your priority is safe sex, the test isn't helping. Half these guys get a false sense of security. The other half know they're dying. They're depressed, they get drunk, and what the hell do you think they do? They don't run out to the rubber store." Charlie was still laughing over rubber store, riffing about Helmet Hut and Trojans R Us, when Terrence and Fiona buzzed up. In the time it took them to get upstairs, Asher cleared his throat and deftly turned his ranting to the opinion that there was no decent Chinese food in Chicago. Yale argued that you just had to go to Chinatown and be willing to eat chicken feet. Terrence and Fiona walked in, arm in arm. Terrence handed Charlie a bottle of wine and said, in his whitest voice, "The wife and I got stuck in the worst traffic, driving in from Sheboygan. Thank God we're fixing up that infrastructure with the trickle-down and whatnot. God bless the USA." They seemed to be doing well, both of Nico's bereaved. But what could you tell from the outside? Fiona's blonde curls always lent her a vibrancy, an alertness, that compensated for any fatigue. And Terrence, he looked thin, but you'd never know he was sick if it weren't for the test. And what good had the test done, really? Maybe he was drinking less. Maybe he was getting more sleep, which was something. "That envelope," Asher whispered to Yale. "Not till coffee." Yale was antsy all night, unable to focus. It was partly that it was late November. He always grew agitated as the sun grayed its way into hibernation. And maybe it was partly Asher's presence, too. Although usually that was a pleasant kind of agitation. Maybe it was the fact that Teddy would show up later. And this was the first time he'd seen Teddy since Nico's memorial, when his phantom self had vanished upstairs with Teddy's phantom self. And beneath all that was the fact that he was still waiting for Nora's Polaroids to arrive. that as soon as he'd gotten excited about this project, it had stalled out. He'd written her a nice note, sent the lawyer a carbon copy. Then separately, as promised, he sent some photos of the gallery space, and heard nothing. He'd messed up. He'd assumed her number was in the file, and now Cecily said she'd never had it, that they'd communicated entirely by mail. Information didn't have it either. He wrote to Nora's lawyer, asking if he'd heard from her, suggesting that he'd love her number. Stanley wrote back that he'd learned better than to bother Nora, but she was sure to be in touch. No number. Yale called Stanley, whose phone was on his letterhead, but the secretary said that since he was semi-retired, he only worked some days. And no, she couldn't predict which days, but she'd take a message. Yale called again, and she said she'd repeat the message. He was afraid of seeming pushy, of the lawyer telling Nora he had a bad feeling about those Northwestern folks. And so, over the main course, while everyone else debated Live Aid, with which Asher had some arcane quibble, Yale brought Nora up with Fiona.
"Isn't she incredible?" Fiona said. "I want to be here when I grow up. She had affairs with so many artists. Seriously."
"You could run out and have sex with artists right now."
"Oh, you know what I mean. She had this life, you know? She was the only one in the whole family who didn't shut out Nico. She sent him a check for $50 every month."
Nico hadn't even needed to come out to her, Fiona said. Nora had known all along. But no, Fiona didn't have her number. She'd seen her at a family wedding up in Wisconsin in August. Then as they sat there talking about art, about Paris, that's when Fiona had told her about Yale's position. Told Nora she should write to him soon. Nora had called her, she said, to say how much she liked Yale.
"And she must love you," she said. "Because it's the only time she's ever called me."
Maybe her father would have the number. She promised she'd try to get it. Yale knew better than to expect follow-through. Down the table, Terence was talking about his new meditation practice, his crystals, his stress relief cassettes, and Asher was laughing, shaking his head. "Listen," Terence said, "you keep figuring out how to save the world. I'm going to work on buying myself a few extra months. If I have to eat the damn crystals, I'll do it." Asher said, "I can tell you a couple other places you can put your crystals." Fiona punched his arm, hard enough that Asher winced. She told him to behave. Fiona was the one who helped Yale clear the dishes, or at least held open the swinging door that separated the tiny kitchen from the apartment's main room. The others migrated to the living room so Terence could catch the second half of the Cowboys game. Once the water was running, Yale lowered his voice. "Hey, did you tell Charlie I went upstairs with Teddy? After the memorial?"
"Oh, God, Yale, I've been meaning to apologize."
She backed up to the counter and launched herself up to sit there, her feet dangling.
"You know how you get surer of things when you're drunk? I was drunk, and he couldn't find you, and I'd seen you go upstairs, and someone else said they'd seen Teddy go upstairs, and I kept saying, 'Yale is upstairs with Teddy,' because I thought I was being helpful. I guess I wasn't."
"I thought so," Yale said. "That's what I thought. Teddy wasn't even there. He left when the slideshow started."
"Oh, Yale, I didn't mean to make a problem. I heard later that Charlie was... Oh, God."
"It doesn't matter," he said. "It's the least important thing about that night." Yale scraped the plates while Fiona joined everyone in the living room. If he didn't do it now, while Charlie was busy entertaining and pretending to understand American football, then Charlie would insist on doing every dish. When Yale finally walked into the living room, the conversation abruptly stopped. "What?" he said. Charlie said, "I'll tell you later." "No, what?" "Cowboys are winning," Terence said. Asher tried to drink from his glass, but his glass was empty.
"Just tell him," Fiona said.
Charlie patted the couch, bit his lip, stared at the TV.
"I thought I saw your mum."
"Oh. I mean, I did see her. She was a nurse in
It was a Tylenol advert. She said some stuff. Not much. Asher said, "We didn't know your mom was a movie star." He felt dizzy. "She's not." This hadn't happened in a couple of years, this kind of ambush. There was a commercial for Folgers Crystals a while back, in which she was a waitress. She'd been a receptionist for an episode of Simon and Simon. He hated it. Which Charlie must have told them, or why were they looking at him like that? Hated on a gut level, the humiliation of being afforded only the same 2-second shots of his mother that the entire rest of the country was given. Hated that he needed to watch, that he couldn't look away in indifference. Hated that he'd missed seeing her just now. Hated that they'd all seen her without him. Hated that they were pitying him. Hated that he hated it all so much. When Yale was 7, his father had taken him to see Breakfast at Tiffany's. And Yale, knowing his mother was an actress, and that actresses disguised themselves for their roles, became convinced that his mother was the one playing Holly Golightly. He wanted her to be the one singing Moon River, which seemed like just the sort of song his mother might sing to him if she were still around. He soon outgrew the fantasy. But for years, when he had trouble sleeping, he'd imagine Audrey Hepburn singing to him. He said, "It's nice to know she's alive." He grabbed his legal pad from the shelf under the coffee table. He'd been drafting a letter for the annual fund that morning. He snatched up a pen and started circling things that didn't need circling. Fiona said, "Are you okay?" He nodded. And as the game came back on, Charlie twisted one of Yale's curls around his finger. Asher picked up the TV guide and flipped through it as if they might change the channel at any moment. And then the door buzzer sounded. Thank God. Teddy was alone. "Julian has an emergency rehearsal, whatever that means," he said. "He sends his regrets." "Oh my God, it smells amazing!" Teddy always talked like he'd just done a speedball. But it was just the way he was. "So he's not coming at all?" Charlie said. "What did he say exactly?" Terrence said, "I hope this emergency rehearsal is smoking hot." Teddy acted normally, throwing his coat on the back of the couch, hugging everyone. Well, sure. He didn't know anything odd had happened the night of the memorial. It was like having a sex dream about someone, then seeing him the next day. You felt like he had to know. He'd been right there in the dream. So how could things ever be the same between you again? But they always were. Teddy had golden waves cut close to his head. The fact that his skin was always golden tan, even in the middle of winter, made him look like a bronze statue, or like some drawing of Hermes from a children's book of myths. There was a scar in the middle of his upper lip from a cleft palate in infancy, a faint line that might have marred his face, but instead made him irresistible to just about anyone in the market for a twink, which Yale never had been. Teddy was built like an adolescent, 5'4" at most. Charlie busied himself serving the trifle he'd made, avoided looking at either Teddy or Yale. He seemed distracted. He miscounted the bowls, and then he left the serving spoon in the kitchen. Yale wanted to stop him, massage his neck, but he didn't want to draw attention to Charlie's discomfort. He didn't even want to point it out to Charlie himself, who swore he understood now, 100%, that nothing had happened at the memorial. The trifle was one of Charlie's only recipes, and he prided himself on supersaturating the thing with sherry. Yale had learned to count each serving as a drink. "Thief," Teddy said to Fiona when they'd dug in. "Are you old enough for this stuff?" She put on an affronted face. "I am fully 21, she said, "as of September 3rd. "You didn't invite me to your party." "It was only for nice people." Yale imagined she hadn't celebrated at all in the throes of that wretched summer. Her 20th had been a dance party at Nico's with strobe lights. This one she'd probably spent in a waiting room. Teddy said, "I've only got 10 minutes. I'm having a whole dinner at my thesis advisor's." Asher said, "This is your appetizer?" Teddy stuck the spoon in his mouth upside down, pulled it out dramatically by way of answer. he said. It's my palate cleanser. I already ate at my mom's. So how's everyone feeling about the Howard Brown thing?
And then, when there was awkward silence,
they're doing testing.
I'm sure they know, Terrence said.
I mean, you know I'm still anti-test, but maybe these ones can really be anonymous. I mean, if I want real anonymity, I'm going to get tested in Cleveland or something.
Fiona said, Teddy, it's Thanksgiving. We shouldn't...
Asher said, Sure, they'll anonymously give everyone a false sense of security.
Terrence was looking down at his trifle, smoothing the whipped cream flat.
Charlie said, Asher wants everyone to walk around dying of ulcers instead, drinking themselves to death over stress.
Yale kicked him out of the table, but Charlie kept talking.
Does this mean you'll get tested now? Hell no! I don't even think the tests work. How do we know they aren't all part of the same government conspiracy that cooked up the whole virus to begin with? I'm just saying that... Stop!
Fiona slammed her glass onto the table. Teddy opened his mouth, decided better. Terrence said, So?
Hey, what do you call a black guy who studies rocks?
Fiona was the only one who made any noise, a startled giggle. Then she said,
I don't know, what?
A geologist, you bunch of racists.
After the laughter, the conversation, thank God, split into three frivolous directions. Yale got up to put a new record on. Teddy made his excuses and grabbed his jacket and was gone.
Is it time for coffee?
Yale asked. He directed it at Asher, because he was really asking about the envelope. Asher nodded and stood and fetched it off the refrigerator, but no one moved toward the coffee pot.
Let's make this festive, Asher said. Let's have a little ceremony.
He pulled out the papers, asked Charlie for a pen. Terrence said to Fiona, Shall I get down on one knee? Yale looked at Charlie to see if he knew what was going on. Charlie mouthed, Power of attorney. It made sense.
Nico's parents had botched his medical care horribly, moved him to a hospital that didn't even want him there. And then they'd claimed the funeral, too.
Terrence's family, Yale understood, wasn't one he'd want making his medical decisions. Terrence hadn't seen his mother in years, hadn't been back to his childhood home in Morgan Park on the South Side since he graduated high school. Still, it seemed a lot to put on Fiona. She was just a kid.
We've got the limitations stuff filled in, but look that over. And you need to initial one of these three,
Asher said, pointing. He took the cap off a pen and handed it to Terrence.
I want the first one, right? I do not want my life prolonged.
Asher cleared his throat.
That's what we'd talked about, but look them over.
Terrence took a long time reading the page.
Oh,
Fiona said. And then it seemed she had to think of something to say, a thing to fill the silence.
I have to tell you the sweetest story.
She told them how one of the little girls in the family she nannied for, the 3-year-old, could hear the lions and wolves from the Lincoln Park Zoo at night through her bedroom window, and so had assumed, till recently, that the creatures roamed the city at night. Fiona had gotten the mother's permission to walk the girl over after bedtime, to see the animals secure in their enclosures.
I used to cruise the zoo, Charlie said.
Terrence found this hilarious. He put his pen down.
It's true. You remember Martin? That's where I met him. Well, near the zoo.
When Yale first met Charlie, he was seeing a huge bearded guy named Martin who played the drums in a terrible new wave band. How Charlie could go from someone like that to someone like Yale, small, cautious, Yale never could figure out. As Yale spent time with the two of them that summer, it became clear Martin was the one pursuing Charlie. He'd rest a hand on Charlie's shoulder when Yale showed up, keep it there as long as possible. By the time Charlie, in the locker room of the whole house pool, first asked Yale out for a drink, Yale knew Charlie was available. Emotionally, if not logistically.
It was funny. Yale swam at Hull House specifically because there wasn't a scene there. The only friend he ever saw at the pool was Asher, who'd probably chosen it for similar reasons. The place was dank and completely unsexy. And then Charlie started showing up. Yale and Charlie were both wet that day from swimming. And Yale was glad the flush coming over his body might be excused as post-workout blood flow. He learned later that Charlie hated to swim, had been choking down chlorine just so he could run into Yale on the pool deck. They were already friends, but there was something different, even in the most innocent ways, about the intimacy of the locker room. Later, when people asked how they got together, they hated to admit it, to recite what might be the beginning of a porno flick. They went from drinks back to Charlie's place, and Martin quickly became a distant memory, except for the few times he'd pop up to storm past Yale at bars. But Yale had always, because of Martin's size, felt smaller next to Charlie than he might have. Charlie had 5 inches on him. 5 inches and 5 years and 5 IQ points was Yale's joke. But it might as well have been 2 feet. Asher asked Terrence if he had any questions, and Terrence finally shook his head, initialed the papers. He signed on the last page with a tremendous flourish, elbow in the air. Asher said to Fiona, "We need you to be sure." "I am." "Anything that goes wrong," he said, "anyone who challenges this, I'll be there to set them straight. Okay? But listen, you have to consider what could happen if the family shows up."
"We'll deal with that if and when," she said.
"Right." Asher was being careful, speaking slowly. "But the we might not include Terrence, if he's unconscious." Yale refilled Terrence's wine glass. He wished Asher would stop talking. What Terrence feared most, Yale knew, was the variety of sickness that would make him a vegetable, or, worse to Terrence, make him walk around town in a fugue state. Everyone knew how Julian's friend Dustin Giannopoulos, near the end, had walked into unabridged books in the middle of the day with diarrhea running out of his shorts and down his legs. How he'd stood there buying a stack of magazines, manic and oblivious. And how, because it was the fall of 82 and no one had seen this yet, the story had gone around that he was coked out. Yale and Charlie, along with everyone else, had laughed about it until they heard, 2 weeks later, that Dustin had died of pneumonia. Fiona said, "I'm an absolute veteran, Asher." She signed both copies of the document, then pulled the papers up near her mouth like she was going to kiss them, leave a lipstick mark. "Don't," Asher said.
"Kidding."
"Yeesh." She laughed, tucked the pen behind her ear. Asher asked if Yale and Charlie would sign as witnesses. "Yes, of course." "Have you two thought about it?" he asked when they'd finished. He'd been badgering them about signing stuff for ages, but they hadn't yet pulled the trigger when the test came out and made it less urgent. "We really should," Yale said. "Next time, okay?" Terrence had fallen quiet. Fiona had opened another bottle of wine, and Yale had lost track of how many they'd already finished, but he was sure Fiona had drunk more than anyone. Her spoon slid from her fingers and crashed into her empty bowl. She laughed, and so did everyone but Yale. He asked how she was getting home, and she pointed a finger at him, squinted. She said,
"Pixie dust."
By December, Charlie was busier than ever, and he was drinking more coffee than Yale thought was healthy. He'd gotten roped into the planning committee for the pre-Christmas fundraiser that would benefit the new AIDS hotline at Howard Brown, and he was doing all the publicity for the event. They were organizing a silent auction and a raffle upstairs at Ann Sather on Belmont, the restaurant a step up from the pass-the-bucket lectures in someone's apartment. Yale looked forward to it, really. He enjoyed Christmas, which he hadn't celebrated until he took up with Charlie, and he looked forward to seeing everyone. One night, Yale and Charlie were out at a Vietnamese place in Uptown, huddled in sweaters in the back, and Yale said, "Why don't you have Richard do a photo essay on the party? For the paper? Like, artsy and journalistic, not just normal party shots.
someone's hand on a glass, that kind of thing. Charlie set his chopsticks and his rice noodles and looked up at Yale.
Oh my God, he said.
Yes. Yale felt relieved, as if he just evened the score, made up for something. Charlie bit his lip. A code. Wait till we get home. When they did get home, though, Charlie was tired and wanted to crash. He'd had a fever before Thanksgiving, one that hit him hard at first and seemed to be sticking around in milder form. A year ago, they'd have both worried this spelled doom. The fact that a fever could just be a fever now, a cough could just be a cough, a rash could just be a rash. It was a gift the test had given them. This was where Asher was wrong. Knowledge was, in some cases, bliss. Yale brought Charlie herbal tea in bed, told him he should take the next day off. Charlie said,
God, no. If they ever do a whole issue without me, they'll get ideas.
Late the next afternoon, Cecily Pierce called to request that Yale meet her for coffee at Clark's, a neon-laden place that always gave Yale a headache. There was something so agitated in her voice that, on his way there, Yale developed a paranoid theory. Cecily had blacked out some of that night in Door County nearly a month ago, and it had only this morning come back to her that she'd offered Yale cocaine. Put her hand on his leg. Maybe she'd remembered that part, but not the rest. Not the confirmation of Yale's sexuality. The fact that he dropped her off at her room. When he arrived, 5 minutes early, Cecily was already waiting, had already ordered him a to-go cup. She said,
I'm not in a sitting mood.
Yale had been glad to get out of the cold, but she was buttoning her coat, heading out the door. He followed her onto the sidewalk and managed to steer them back toward campus before Cecily could turn toward the chill of the lake. She didn't complain. Her gloves matched her hat and scarf, all a soft cream that made her look fragile. She said,
We have a bit of an issue. Have you heard more from our friend Nora?
Not a word.
Okay, just as well. I'm honestly hoping this whole thing disappears.
She stopped and looked blankly through a store window at some headless mannequins.
There's a donor, a trustee actually, by the name of Chuck Donovan, class of 52. This is someone who gives $10,000 a year to the annual fund, but there's a bequest in place for $2 million. Not our biggest donor of all time, but we need him. We can't throw people like this away.
Of course. Yale sensed he was being reprimanded, but he couldn't imagine what for. She said,
I have to set the stage for you here. This is a man who, and I'm not making this up, once donated a Steinway to the music school. And then, when he had some beef with the dean over there, he came into the building himself and removed the little placard with his name on it, with a tiny screwdriver.
Yale started laughing. He couldn't help it. And Cecily joined. It surely hadn't been funny when it happened, when she'd had to deal with the guy's calls. She started walking again, and Yale dodged students to keep up.
So, I got a call from Chuck Donovan yesterday, and he's been talking to Frank Lerner. Frank is Nora's son. He's the one who owns the house.
Deborah's father, Yale said.
Right. They're both in medical supplies, and I imagine it's a golf buddy situation.
Yale said. So Frank is mad at us and told him so? His coffee was way too hot, and it scalded the middle of his tongue. He wouldn't be able to taste his dinner.
Ha. Yes. More than that. He had a little speech. He said, You can have that woman's art, or you can have my bequest, but you can't have both. Apparently he promised Frank, he said something about a gentleman's promise, that he'd put an end to this. Maybe it's a moot point if we don't hear back from her. And even if the art were real, there's no way it's worth $2 million, right?
She meant it rhetorically, but Yale took in a long breath of frozen air. I mean, it depends what she has. But with the Modiglianis, the Soutine, there's a good chance, if they're real, if there are full paintings in there, if everything's in good condition, that it would be more than $2 million. Cecily was a foot ahead of him, so he couldn't see her face, but he heard the noise she made.
"That's not what I want to hear," she said.
"I'm not going to lie to you."
"Here's the thing, Yo. This goes now from us just taking a chance on the work, maybe getting another donor involved in the authenticity thing, to our paying $2 million for the art. We'd essentially be buying it for $2 million, when it's not even a sure bet."
"Right. He's serious, this Chuck guy? You don't think he's bluffing?"
"I don't get it. He's got no personal investment in this, right? He just wants to look important?"
"His whole life is one big ego trip," she said. "He's the most difficult donor I've ever worked with," Yale said, carefully.
"Is it possible, though, that the reason he's so keen on helping Nora's son is that he knows the art is real? If these were fakes or quick scribbles, he's not going to throw his weight around to help his golf buddy."
"Chuck Donovan is no art expert," Cecily said. "I doubt Nora's son is either. And listen, it would be one thing if we were looking at a verified Rembrandt. But I have people to answer to. You understand?"
"I do." The sun had fully set, and Yale wished he had a hat.
"If it is real," she said. "No offense, but why on earth would she want us to have it?"
"Good question." "It was. Why not set her family up? Why not go to the Art Institute?"
He said, "But let's say we get a look at this art, and it's really promising, something worth maybe a lot more than $2 million. And remember that the thing about art is it often goes up in value. Then it would be worth it, right?"
He wasn't making Cecily happy. She walked faster, watching her feet. She said,
"Can't we just wait till it's all authenticated?
That could take years. We wait around, Nora dies, the son does Lord knows what, and the whole thing falls apart."
"I'm not your boss, Yale. And technically, I can't tell you what to do. But Chuck Donovan makes things difficult for a lot of people, and he might make them difficult for you."
A woman with a golden retriever darted between them, and the dog sniffed Yale's leg and managed to wipe its mouth there, leaving a streak of muddy drool on his khakis. The owner apologized, and Yale looked at his watch. He and Charlie had theater tickets, and now he'd have to change when he got home. It was already 5:05. He said,
"I understand what you're saying, and maybe this is a conversation you should have with Bill as well."
"Oh, Bill," she said. "All Bill does is ask questions. I always feel like I'm being dealt with. I'm talking to you because this is about money. And I want to ask that you don't screw me over. Okay? I have a kid to provide for, and my job is always on the line. This year more than most, for reasons I won't even go into."
Something had changed in her voice. And whether or not it was intentional, a careful manipulation, Yale felt that she was letting him in. That she was desperate, in fact. He said,
"Yeah, no, I get it. Ultimately, I do have a boss, and that's Bill. I'll apprise him of the situation. If we're lucky, the stuff is obviously fake. End of story. And if not, we'll talk again." She said, "I'm going to leave you here and pick up some groceries." And instead of shaking his hand, she squeezed his bicep. On the way back to the gallery, the wind was harsher and in his face. He tucked his head and walked like a charging bull. He wasn't sure what, if anything, he'd promised. Really just a future conversation. How ridiculous to be scolded and warned over what was essentially a pipe dream. He felt for her, he did. But acid was burning his throat. The wind tore at his skin. Yale and Charlie had long held tickets to see Julian and Hamlet at Victory Gardens.
"Well," Julian had said when he invited them, "not so much at Victory Gardens as in it, like on off nights."
The show was put on by the Wild Rumpus Company, and this was how it operated. In other people's theaters. On nights when the house would otherwise be dark. It was the last show Nico had set designed. He just completed the sketches when he got sick, and the company had executed things as faithfully as it could. Julian was the one who'd introduced Nico to the theater world, who'd hooked him up with the company. But then Nico was the kind of guy who made you want to do things for him. He always smiled so earnestly, looked so pleasantly shocked that you'd be willing to do him some small favor. Yale rushed home from Evanston and changed out of his mud-smeared slacks, only to find that Charlie was suddenly uninterested in attending. He was lying on the bed, staring at the ceiling. "Did you see what they wrote in the Reader?" he said. "They called it unnerving." "It's Hamlet," Yale said. "It's supposed to be unnerving." "Do you know how long that play is? We'll be old before it's over." Yale had taken off his loafers and was slipping his feet, again, into Nico's shoes. They'd stretched a bit, the leather holding the shape of his toes. "Oh," Charlie said. "Your dad called, I think." Yale's father always phoned within the first few days of the month, regularly enough that Yale assumed it was something he scheduled, an item on his to-do list, like checking the batteries in the smoke detectors. It wasn't an insult. It was just the way his father's accountant brain worked. But if Charlie picked up, Leon Tishman wouldn't leave a message, would just stammer that he must have misdialed. 5 years ago, when Yale was so newly in love with Charlie that he couldn't help shouting it from the rooftops, he tried telling his father he was in a relationship. His father said something like, "bup, bup, 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 bup," a sound effect to cover Yale's voice, to stop his talking. Yale said, "He was due for a call." "Yeah, but he didn't say anything. Bit unusual. Just breathing." "Could be your secret admirer," Yale said. "Was it heavy breathing?" But Charlie didn't find it funny. He said, "Anyone else it might have been? Because it was odd." Yale didn't like the direction this was headed. He could have gotten defensive, or he could have just reassured Charlie. But instead he said, "Nico did promise to haunt us." Charlie rolled over, buried his face in the pillow. He said, muffled, "I really don't want to go tonight." "Come on, get up. Let's just do the first half, so you can say you saw the set design." "I do want to see the set. I just don't want to watch the play." "What's this about? Julian? Because I don't get it. We can't suddenly not have friends just because you're going through this paranoid phase." "Don't stop that," Charlie said. And Yale was about to counter that he hadn't really started it. But Charlie was sitting up now, opening the dresser to change his socks. It was an all-male production. Ophelia and Gertrude in drag, and not only were Guildenstern and Julian's Rosencrantz clearly meant to be a couple, so were Hamlet and Horatio. Yale found it all darkly hilarious, with lines like, "What a piece of work is a man," suddenly taking on new meaning. But Charlie didn't laugh, kept folding his program. Nico's set design was bleak and post-apocalyptic. Hamlet didn't live in a castle, apparently, but an alleyway. All fire escapes and dumpsters. It was strangely beautiful, if slightly more suited to West Side Story. If Nico had been around to oversee things, Yale imagined he might have added more color, graffiti, light. Julian looked, as always, made for the stage. His dark hair glowed like wet paint. In high school, Yale had wished he'd had the acting bug. He didn't want the social fallout, but he wanted desperately something to talk about with the guys who got up there, and, with no apparent self-consciousness, sang and even danced their way through Guys and Dolls, through Camelot. But the thought of going on stage was terrifying, beyond just the stigma. He could never have opened his mouth up there. He'd mentioned it, offhand, to the shrink he'd seen at U of M, a guy who would occasionally suggest that Yale wasn't so much homosexual as lonely. "Could that desire be about your mother?" he'd said. "A desire to connect with your mother through the theater?" and Yale had brushed it off, said that wasn't it at all. But he'd wondered, in the years since, if it weren't even simpler than that. If he didn't possess some latent theater gene that would never emerge, but that he could feel, now and then, tugging. It wasn't till halfway through the first act that Yale spotted Asher Glass 2 rows ahead. The stage lights glowed through the backs of his ears, turned them translucent so Yale could see their thread-like veins. At intermission, they found Asher in the lobby, looking at the racks of books and t-shirts the company had brought in for sale. Yale said, "It's not bad, right?" "Jesus, I don't know. I don't know why I'm here. I can't concentrate, can you?" "I think it's okay to let your mind wander." Asher looked back blankly. "No, I mean Teddy. I'm thinking about Teddy." Charlie's voice turned thin. "Is he, what, is he sick?" Asher let out a strange, short burst of laughter. "Someone broke his nose. Last night." "What?" "They banged his head into the sidewalk. He was on campus at Loyola. He teaches some undergrad class, right? And he was walking back afterward and someone just..." He pantomimed it on his own head, grabbing his hair and thrusting himself forward. "On the sidewalk. It wasn't a robbery, even." "Is he... he's fine. He's got a bandage across and 2 stitches and a black eye. He's home if you... but he's okay. It's more the fact of it. They have no idea who did this. 1 person, 5, students, punks, some asshole just strolling through campus." "Have you seen him?" Charlie asked. "Yeah. Yeah, I went to help him deal with the cops. You know how they are. Even if someone's caught, they'll say it was gay panic. Say you put your hand on their pants, whatever. You're covering this in the paper, right?" "In general?" Charlie said. "Violence?" "No, this. Will you write about Teddy?" Charlie pulled at his lip. "It'd be up to Teddy, and my editor. You're gonna cover it. I'm following up tomorrow." And then it was time to head back in. Yale tried to pay attention, but he saw Teddy's face hitting the sidewalk again and again. And because there were so many different ways he could picture it, he was compelled to picture them all. Undergrads following him out of class. Teenagers on bikes. A sudden inspiration. Teddy was so small. He closed his eyes, squeezed the image out physically. He glanced at Charlie a few times, tried to read his face. Charlie drummed his fingers on the armrest, but he'd done that through the first act, too. Afterward, Yale wanted to join the crowd waiting to congratulate Julian. Asher and those guys from the sandwich shop where Julian worked, and the chubby accountants Julian used to see, but Charlie had to get to work. "You can hang back if you want," he said. But Yale wasn't an idiot. That Friday was the day before Hanukkah began. And so when Yale walked into work and Bill Lindsay grinned and said there was something waiting on his desk, Yale was terrified it was going to be a menorah. Bill was either overly interested in Judaism, or had been using a feigned interest in Judaism as a way to awkwardly flirt. But instead, Yale found a large envelope with a return address in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. He felt adrenaline flood his thighs, as if the situation might require sprinting. Bill hadn't followed him in, which he easily could have. He also could have opened the envelope. Yale had to give the man credit. He knew how to let people have their moments. Yale hadn't told Bill yet about his conversation with Cecily. He'd been hoping to ignore the problem away. Bill did know the basic details of their trip north, and he knew that Yale was intrigued by the artwork. That was the word Yale had carefully chosen. Intrigued, rather than excited. In part because it wasn't Yale's place to get worked up about art, or to assess its value. He tore into the package and spread the Polaroids, more than a dozen of them, across the surface. A blur of color and lines and reflective glare. There was a letter, too, but that could wait. He sat and closed his eyes, and blindly plucked one photo to hold up in the window light. It was a Fujita. Or it was meant to be a Fujita, he reminded himself. And at the very least it was instantly identifiable as such. And it was not a work he was familiar with, not a copy of something famous. A young woman in profile. A simple drawing done in ink, small bits, her hair, her green dress, filled in with watercolor. Charmingly incomplete, yet fully realized. Signed in the corner, both in Japanese and in Roman letters. Okay, he said. Okay. This was just going to be one of those times when he talked to himself. He would hand the photos over to Bill this afternoon, but for now they were his. He put his palms flat on the desk. He did not want a $2 million repercussion. Didn't want whatever legal battle might come from Nora's family. Didn't want to make the phone call to Cecily. Didn't want his job on the line over this. Didn't want even to start hyperventilating right now with excitement. And yet, if these turned out to be real, this would be the find of his career. This was the dream version of his job. What Indiana Jones was to a regular archaeology professor, Yale was right now to a regular development director of a modest gallery. The Modigliani sketches struck him next. Well, sketches was the wrong word. They were simple drawings. Perhaps studies for something else. Perhaps, as Nora suggested, pieces made in payment to a model. All appeared to be done in blue crayon. Three of the four were signed. All nudes. If these were real, if they could be authenticated, they'd be worth a lot more than the pencil sketches Yale had been imagining. He examined three more Fujita line drawings. A woman in a robe, a woman holding a rose in front of bare breasts, a pile of fruit, plus a painting of an empty bedroom and a chicken-scratch pencil study of a man in a jacket, neither of which seemed to match any of the artists Nora had originally listed. It was when he picked up a wonderfully smudgy soutine in one hand. God, this was a full painting, swirled and vertiginous and wild, that he stood straight up and then sat immediately down again, his knees not working properly. This piece showed, identifiably, the same woman as in the Fujitas. Blonde, small ears, small breasts, impish tilt to her smile. Nora, presumably. If he tilted his head, it kind of even looked like Fiona. Was he nuts? It really did look like Fiona. The Modiglianis were too abstract to pin to Nora, all sinews and pointed ovals. One of the photos showed not artwork, but a shoebox full of papers. And so after he'd sorted and examined every other Polaroid, Yale looked at the letter, typewritten on law firm letterhead, to see if it explained. Dear Mr. Tishman, my greetings for the holiday season. Please find herein 19 Polaroid photographs documenting the collection of Nora Marcus Lerner. Mrs. Lerner wishes to remind you that the pieces are the work of the artists Chaim Soutine, Amadeo Modigliani, Jean Ebuterne, Suguharu Fujita, Jules Passin, Jean Metzinger, Sergei Mukankin, and Renko Novak, completed between the years 1910 and 1925. Additionally, one photograph shows the collection of correspondence, personal photographs, and other mementos Mrs. Lerner had amassed during her time in Paris. Mrs. Lerner and I are delighted by the Brig Gallery's interest in the collection, and look forward to your further communication. With warm regards, Stanley Toynbee, Esquire. Yale walked down to Bill's office, his legs still shaking, but Bill had stepped out. Yale left a post-it on the door. I have good news and bad news. He went back and drafted a letter to Nora. He'd wait for Bill's permission to send it, effusing over the photographs, saying that the sooner they began to work together, the sooner these pieces could receive their public due. He added that it might be best if she keep all correspondence private for now. He hoped she'd understand this to mean she shouldn't talk to her son. He called Fiona and left a message.
"You made my year," he said. "You and your artist-stripping aunt."
He did not call Cecily. As she pointed out, she wasn't his boss. And when Bill came back, when he stood there cooing over the Polaroids like they were newborn kittens, when Yale told him about Chuck Donovan, his threats and his $2 million and the plaque he'd pried off the Steinway, Bill puffed out his cheeks but never stopped staring at the photos. He said, "This is a lot more than $2 million, Yale. And I'm being very conservative. I mean, look at these. Look at these. You'll figure out, Cecily. You will. You're my miracle worker." On the way home, Yale bought flowers and an apple pie. He smiled at strangers on the L and didn't feel the cold. 2015. Fiona slept well. From whenever Serge had brought her home until 3 a.m. She lay still a long time, not wanting to make noise and rouse Richard. Wasn't he an old man, despite everything? And then she fell back asleep and dreamed that her seatmate from the flight was swimming with her in a pool. He had something that belonged to Claire. And when Fiona found her, would she hand it over? He pulled from his swimsuit pocket, slowly, like a magician, Nico's long orange scarf. When Fiona finally came out into the kitchen, Richard was at the breakfast table, the morning sun illuminating his computer, his hands. He typed quickly, mouthing words. "Emails," he said. "Did you ever think we'd be so buried under mountains of these things?" She sliced a banana and asked if Serge was up yet. Richard laughed. "The question should be if he's back yet, which he is. He fell into bed around 4. Serge had a number of boyfriends, he said. None serious. "Mostly Italians. He does pick lovely ones." Fiona knew better than to ask whether it bothered Richard. He seemed tickled by the whole situation, by Serge's youth and energy. Richard stretched luxuriously. A lion in a bathrobe, a sun king on his throne. He closed his computer and said, "Look at this gorgeous weather, just for you. I wish you could enjoy Paris. Next visit you will. I don't know when I died, but this is my Valhalla." He told her they'd blocked off the Rue des Deux Ponts during the night for the movie shoot. She looked out the window. No crowds yet. No movie stars, but there were trucks. The sound of angry horns as drivers learned they couldn't go through. He said she might cross the bridge to find a cab, but she didn't want a cab. Even though her legs ached, she wanted to walk again. Only if Serge went with her, Richard said. He didn't want her getting lost out there. He didn't want her passing out, was what he didn't say. Serge roused himself, despite Fiona's protests, to put on his jacket and come along, half the time dragging behind like a sleepwalker, half the time speedwalking ahead and deciding where they should go. She grew used to the back of his head, his dark, floppy hair, his long and ruddy neck. Yesterday, on the back of his motorbike after the cafe, she'd insisted he take her on the Pont de l'Archeveche, broad and nearly empty. A bride and groom posing for a photographer, but no Claire. Of course, that bridge, or any bridge, would be the last place they'd find her. Life didn't work like that. Now they walked down the quays, Fiona showing Claire's photo to every artist she saw, the ones with canvases the size of index cards for sale, the man drawing caricatures, even a clown in full makeup who sat eating a sandwich. Serge stood back to text, to light a cigarette, although his translation would have been helpful. "Elle est artiste," Fiona managed each time, but she wished she could elaborate, explain that her daughter was not a pregnant teenager, not a hapless runaway. They all shook their heads, bemused. Serge led her to Shakespeare and Company, which Fiona had known was a bookstore, but which also turned out to have beds upstairs, Serge explained, for lonely